to have you here.
Terrific. Thanks, Gareth. You missed one this morning, so it was a great list of good mornings in multiple languages. This morning, we're going to tackle Israel, so we should probably do it with Shalom, Boker Tov, which is good morning in Hebrew. And this is a little. Let's see if we can get this. There we look at that. Who's that guy? That was me a long time ago. Apparently, I asked Gareth, what qualified me to speak on the subject of Israel? And he said, well, you've been there. So that's pretty good. I wonder, how many of us have already been there? There's quite a few of us. And look, we could take trade places or something. I had the privilege of living there for 2.5 years, and I studied at the Hebrew University. My Hebrew is now a little bit rough, but I used to be fluent, taking courses in the university and all of that kind of stuff. It was a wonderful time of life, a time of lots of moments that have really shaped my life. You know, talking about shaping, hey, look, it's Rachel. Her and I met while we were living and studying in Israel. Hey, there's lots of things that happen there that are quite different from what happens here. Now, some of these things, there's some things that I can remember very, very well, and they're kind of these habits or patterns that I got into because of the things that I did repeatedly. So I studied under an Orthodox rabbi while I was there for part of the time, and every time I went to his house, we ate food and we drank. There was always a drink of wine that happened with dinner. And so one of the things that happened is that you, in that household, is that you pray a lot. You find ways to pray. You mark moments of the day. In fact, every moment of the day is pretty much marked by prayer. So there's a prayer even before you open your eyes in the morning. But before we ate any food, we would say, Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam, Asher Kedishanu Vitzuyanu Al Natilat Yadayim, which was a little prayer for the washing of our hands. So every time you washed your hands, you recognized that God was giving you the opportunity to clean your hands. Now here's a prayer that if some of you, every time you were to drink wine, you would have this absolutely nailed, because it goes, Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam Borei Pri HaGofen, which is, thank you, Lord our God of the universe, for giving us fruit of the vine. Now, probably a favorite prayer for many. Now, there was also prayers for special occasions. Now, here's this prayer for this special occasion. Oh, I'm going to try to read it. I'll read it off this screen. It's not one that I memorized. But this one, Shechichenu, is a prayer. It's like over 1,500 years old. And it's a prayer for every special occasion. Now, what's a special occasion? A special occasion is, like an example would be, if you haven't seen a friend for 30 days, you would offer this prayer to God upon meeting up with this friend. How cool! Marking friendship as a special occasion and being reunited with someone. You use it, it was used at the founding of the State of Israel when they declared independence. That ceremony ended with this prayer. When you land in Israel off of the airplane, you'll find that all of the Orthodox are reading this, or reciting this prayer as a note of thanksgiving and marking the occasion of arriving in Israel. And it goes, Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam, Shechichenu V'Kimenu V'Higienu Lizman Hazeh. And you can see what it says in English, and we're going to have a chance to look at that maybe a little bit later. Prayer is a central part of the life of Israel. And the reason why it's so important is because it is the temple no longer exists. And so prayer has taken that central place, a chance to remind us all that of God and that he is there. A blessing for a special time. One of the things, so Gareth said I got to talk about Israel, and I thought, well, this is a pretty big topic. Yeah, who knows where this could have gone? Thanks, Gareth, for entrusting me with this very big topic, because we could have gone into all kinds of weird places, right? But we're not doing that today. I thought what I would do is actually give us a little introduction to those very first moments, those special moments of Israel, and use those special moments to give us a little bit of insight into the moments of our lives and to what God is doing in and amongst us. So that's what we're going to do today. And one of the very first things that we've got to think about is, like, where did this name Israel come from in the first place? So we've got a few scripture verses today. And here's the first one. Stories that we probably all know. So Jacob was left alone. Left alone. And he wrestled with him, a man, with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, so that the hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said to him, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he answered. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome." Now, the story of Jacob is a bit of an interesting one. So we know, throughout the Old Testament, God is described as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so Jacob was one of the patriarchs, the third generation after the selection of Abraham. And what's the story with Jacob and his life? So anybody remember any Jacobs in the room? There's got to be a Jacob or two around here. What does the name Jacob mean? Anybody know? Well, so remember that he grabs Esau's heel, right? Coming out of the womb, he grabs Esau's heel. So he could be like just simply be described as heel. But the name Jacob is also a term for deceiver, right? Deceiver. So one who kind of runs his life through deception and taking advantage of those around him through deception. And one of the things that we think about when we think about that is that he has thought that to get his way through life, to be successful in life, it's all up to him. And that he is going to manipulate life in order to get what he wants. Right? There's no one else who's going to look after Jacob but Jacob. And it says that he wrestles with men. That is the story of his life. He is wrestling with people from the time he was in the womb until this very moment. And in this moment is really the first time that we see that Jacob is willing to wrestle with God. Up until this point in time, he has wrestled with people alone. And now God, God reaches out to him and wrestles with him. God has pursued Jacob, and what's the first thing that Jacob does when God pursues him is he wrestles with God. This story of Israel this morning is for all of us who are willing to wrestle with God. Some of us are still wrestling with the concept of God, that he exists. Wrestle hard. God's big enough for the tough questions. For those of us, we're still wrestling sometimes with what does God do for our lives? What is God's intention for our lives? Jacob, here in this story, encounters God. He wrestles with him, and he recognizes that this life is not just a material life, and it's not always just up to him. What's interesting in this story is you see, this is where the angel prophesies that Jacob's name will be changed. It's actually only in chapter 35 where God goes to him and actually changes his name. And so God says to him, you will no longer be Jacob. You will not be one who solely wrestles with people on your own merit and on your own strength. You will be one who wrestles with God. And it is your wrestling with God that will now define your life. It's quite a powerful story. And so after this, so we typically call it the nation of Israel today, right? We just call it, we call it Israel. But it is the nation of Israel. It's the nation that has come from Jacob, one who has wrestled with the world and who now wrestles with God, and is wrestling with God is the defining characteristic. Hey, has anybody seen this thing, this big green thing? Anybody have any idea what it might be? It is the burning bush that didn't burn up. You can find it. I've seen it. The picture of me was a little bit grainy, so I decided not to show that one and show this one instead. This burning bush is actually in a monastery. See, this is a fun thing to go check out. Everybody's wanted to see the burning bush. It's no longer on fire, but it's at the St. Catherine's Monastery. Yeah? St. Catherine's Monastery at the base of Mount Sinai. You can go and find it. So one of the next things, the next story I wanted to call out was, he, Moses, came to Horeb, or the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that through the bush was on fire. Though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. Okay, we know this story. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. What a curious story. One of the things that I think is the most amazing part of this story, and that is so reflective of our lives, is that it was Moses who thought he was going over to discover something. That it was he that was the primary actor on the stage. That he was the center of his own little universe. And yet, what is it? It is God. What is actually happening? It is God who is there, who is unveiling himself to Moses. God is revealing himself to Moses, and Moses' life is being forever changed as a result of this. What happens in that story is that God is going to reach out to Moses and give him a new job, a new vocation, a new calling. And the Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. So in Jacob's time, when they entered Israel following that story with Joseph, there were 70 people who go in to Egypt. There are now roughly 600,000 men who are living in Egypt, and they are crying out in slavery. They're crying out because of the burden. And God has said, let's take a look. What does God do? He says, I have seen, I have heard, I am concerned, I have come, and I will bring. God is acting in the lives of these people, and the people are not yet aware of it. History is in motion. God is acting, and yet their circumstances are still incredibly difficult. It's a little bit like life, isn't it? God cares. He is concerned, even when the circumstances don't necessarily make you feel that he is there. God fundamentally cares. What the story of Israel is the story of a group of people who are working ever so hard and a God who cares. One of the things that we see when the next major moment is the story of the Passover, and on that same night, I, God, will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn of both people and animals. And I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. What I think is so interesting about this passage and this story, there's many, many things that happen in the Passover, right? Many, many things, and many of you will know them. But what I thought I would point out here is, if you think back to the previous passage, it's the conditions of slavery and the hard work is what the people are crying about. Their suffering is what they're crying about. What does God say here? Where is judgment coming? Is it on the Egyptians? Is it on the slave drivers? No, he's bringing judgment here in this verse on all the gods of Egypt. Now, why is it, do you think? Like, God knows, obviously, that the gods of Egypt are like that statue. They're just a block of wood, a piece of stone. He knows that there is nothing there. Yet why is it, do you think, that God says he's going to bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt? I wonder if it's not because the Egyptians and the Israelites were all pursuing something. The Egyptians were pursuing greatness as a nation. They were building temple after temple. One gigantic monument to their gods after another. And serving those gods, serving the gods of wealth, of power, serving the gods of reputation and esteem, serving those things drove them to behave in a certain way to enslave a group of people and bring about tremendous suffering. And God says in this passage that he is bringing judgment on the gods, the ones that actually have enslaved not only the Israelites, but also the Egyptians. Love it. Love it. And you know what's interesting also in this passage? It says, a sign for you. Now, we normally think that, the blood on the doorposts was a sign for God and the angel of death roving across Egypt, right? We normally think of it like, oh, I'm going to pass by when I see the blood on the doorposts. So it's kind of like God needed directions, right? That's normally how we think about it. But God says here, this isn't a sign for me. I know already who my people are. I have chosen these people. They are my people. I know these people. So why does he need the sign? The sign is there for the Israelites. It is there for them. What is it that's about to happen? The sign is there that it is God who is at work. It is not them who are bringing out their deliverance. It is God who's bringing about their deliverance. It is God is the one who is saving them from slavery. It is not them. It is not their actions. God is teaching them that not only that he cares, but that he acts. And that is why they put this on their doorpost. It is a sign for them. Oh, who's this guy? Yep, that's me. My hair had gone a little crazy, so I had climbed Mount Sinai. I was showerless for like a while, and had climbed Mount Sinai and done all of that stuff. And then I got to the Red Sea, the next moment in Israel's history, and probably not quite like this, I know, and gone for a swim. And I came out, and my hair kind of dried like that. It was a moment I won't forget of how good that felt. Anyway, I didn't part the Red Sea. You know the story about the parting of the Red Sea. Just thought we needed a Red Sea photo in here just to kind of mark the moment in the life of Israel. So the next thing that happens is, God saves them, obviously, takes them through the Red Sea. God's doing all of this stuff, right? God is acting miraculously, wondrously, all of that stuff. And he brings them to Mount Sinai. Yep, that's a picture of Mount Sinai. Anybody who here has climbed Mount Sinai? There's got to be a few. A handful. So cool. What a great event that is. On the first day of the third month, after the Israelites left Egypt, on this very day, now if you obey, so God's now talking to the people. He goes, now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you are to speak to the Israelites. So Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people and set before them all the words the Lord had commanded him to speak. The people all responded together, "We will do everything the Lord has said." Oh, really? Well, it doesn't exactly turn out like that, does it? What I love about this passage is that God has just done all of these miraculous things, by the way, since the parting of the Red Sea, so within a couple of months, since the parting of the Red Sea, not only has God brought water from a rock, he has also wiped out the Amalekites. The Amalekites attacked the Israelites. Moses goes on a hill, holds up his hands. Amalekites get wiped out. Everybody recognizes this is God's doing. So we think 10 plagues, Red Sea, water from rock, Amalekites. Like, by the way, these people were slaves. They weren't like an army, blah, 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 right? So, like, it's clear. God is at work. God is the one who delivers. It is God who acts. And in all of these cases, all of those things, what did the Israelites do? Zippo. Right? Nothing. Now, God says to them this. all of a sudden, the Israelites are going to be the ones who are going to do everything. Do you ever get the sense that we too might fall into that trap? We jump to that, don't we? It's now all up to me. And yet it's God who's done everything. Probably gives us pause about the fact that we serve the God who has saved us, who's redeemed us, who loves us, who forgives us. But there are choices to be made. And that's what God has put in front of the Israelites. Will you serve me and me alone is what he asks of them. What's interesting about, another interesting thing about this verse is that probably most of our Bibles aren't going to do this justice, because on that very first verse, most of our Bibles are going to translate it to say, on that day. But the Hebrew is Hayom Hazeh, which is on this very day. On this day. So our Bibles say on that day, but God's word says on this day. Why do you think it says on this day? This is the day that God gives the Ten Commandments. This is the day where God gives them these choices. The reason that it says on this day rather than on that day is because this is something that happens every day. It is today too. It is just as much today that God asks us, will you let him be the one God of your life, the one Lord, the one who has delivered you? Every day there are choices. Every moment there are choices. There are choices to be made this very day. All right. Let's take a look at some of the choices. Oh, I'm running out of time. We're going to speed it up a little bit. So on this very day, we too are given some choices. These are a bit wordy, but like Jacob wrestling with the angel, God too is looking to take our eyes off of all of our works in this world, all of our pursuits and the things that we do quite physically ourselves. And he says, are you willing today, this very day, to make room for him in our lives? Number two, making God the center of your life gives you a new identity and a new purpose, just like what he did with Jacob. I guess the question for me that I think about there is, he too has given all of us the opportunity for a new identity. How are we living that new identity today? Moses learned that God was calling him today, this very day. What are we doing to listen to God's voice in our lives? When he is speaking to us, there may very well be a multitude of burning bushes around us. Have we opened our eyes to those burning bushes? God heard the Israelites in Egypt. He was gravely concerned, and he acted. God, in 2 Peter, we hear, God cares for you. The same God that heard the Israelites, that parted the sea and took that people, that same God acts, and he cares for you. God brought judgment on Egypt's gods. Today, this very day, God asks, what are the things that we have put in front of him? What are the things that we've made that are more important than him? What are the things that keep us awake at night? What are our ambitions? What are the things that we are obsessed about? What are the habits that are getting in the way? What are the distractions that are taking our eyes off of him? You know what? You put those five questions up there, it feels pretty hard, doesn't it? That is a tough set of things we can learn from Israel. Obviously, you know what? God was trying to teach Israel a lesson. He's trying to teach us as well. You know, the Israelites, they wandered in the desert for 40 years. Why do you think they had to wander in the desert for 40 years? Sometimes we think it's because of God's judgment on them for when they sent the spies in and then they said, well, we can't do it. It kind of goes like, no kidding. You can't do it on your own. Right? And he made them wander in the desert for another 40 years so that they might learn the truths of those stories we've already talked about. Think of it. For 400 years, they had been slaves in Egypt. For 400 years, they had been thinking the wrong way. For 400 years, they said it was just the work of their hands that built these monuments. For 400 years, they thought they were alone. For 400 years, it was all up to them. We too, we live in a society today where we are pummeled by all of the messages, the very same messages the Israelites learned in Egypt. God knew that to make that truly a nation of priests, a holy nation, set apart for him, a nation that was going to be something special for the rest of the world, a nation through which all of the world might be blessed, that they needed time to learn that lesson. They needed to shed their identity as slaves. They needed to shed all of the things they had learned in Egypt in order to be that new people. Where is this picture taken from? Anybody got any idea? It is from, come on, where is it? A tomb? That's the tomb? That's a good idea. Any others? Oh, that would be good in Qumran. Cleft of the rock. Well done, Wayne. So on top of Mount Sinai, you will find a spot. There's fences and grates and stuff like that trying to prevent people from doing what I did. So young people, I would not recommend you do this. Sure was fun and made a great photo, though. And anyway, you get the idea. Cleft of the rock. Why? Why was there necessary for there to be a cleft in the rock? And the Lord said, I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name. But he said, you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live. Then the Lord said, there is a place near me where you may stand on a rock. When my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock, cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will remove my hand, and you will see my back, but my face must not be seen. You think about on Mount Sinai, there was thunder, there was lightning, there was earthquakes, there was fear. While God acted, while he moved, while he did those wondrous things, he was still far off. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Once again, God is acting. He is at work. He is still the one, and he came in person to be as one of us, that we might know him personally, that we might be able to relate to the God, the creator of the universe, and we might say, he is my friend. The God who acts is still the God who's acting. He is no longer far away. He is one that we might know. From Israel, we learn, know God, discover and be discovered. Find freedom. All of those things, those ambitions, those obsessions, all of those things, those anxieties, all of those things that take our eyes off of God, believe it or not, they are all little g gods. They are things that we have allowed to control our lives, and it's time to find freedom. Freedom through what Jesus has done for us. Discover our purpose. We too are a kingdom of priests, and God has given us a new identity that we might say we are Christians, ones who love God and who are loved by him. The gospel makes a difference. It transforms lives. It allows us to give a freedom to make a difference in the lives of others by sharing that very same love of our Lord. He is a good God who loves us, each one. I thought I would end off with Shekinah again, because you know what? Every moment, this very moment, is a chance to make decisions about what we do with our lives, of what we give to God, of where we let him take control, of where we give it to him that he might free us and allow us to be the people that he has called us to be. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has granted us life, sustained us, and enabled us to reach this occasion, this moment where we can make change in our lives and give more thanks to him.